All right, hold on.
Hey.
Right, how's it going?
Good. Just about to go live, so
Perfect.
perfect timing.
Can y'all hear me okay?
Yep. Sound lovely, my
Sweet.
guy.
Wonderful. All
Right, going live in 3, 2, 1.
Awesome.
Hey, Ramblers. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Reptile Ramblings. As always, I'm your host, Nate, and joined by my parochial guest, Mr. Brian McDowell.
Are you always going to have an adjective to introduce me like that? But I love
I need
it.
to think of better ones, but
Hey, you do them on the fly, so I love it. But the both of us are highly what do you call it, esteemed or graced by having Eric on the show.
hold up.
Did we lose you?
Uh-oh.
Oh.
What's happening? Run.
Look good on our end.
Here we go.
Good.
Hold on. I'm hearing some feedback. Hold up. Uh-oh, hold on. I'm hearing some, like, it's repeating the audio for some reason. Hold up. Uh-oh.
It might be your speaker. Do you have headphones that you can plug in instead?
Yeah, I can get some headphones. Hold up. Headphones.
And
Well,
so guess that was the best guest we've had.
well, in the meantime, you guys want to check out our first and ever sponsor, Serpentine Expeditions. So, if you decide to log on to Serp and record a, not record, book a trip of Serpentine Expeditions,
Yes.
when you go to checkout, please use code CK25 at checkout for $100 off your order. Which, in this economy,
Okay.
$100 is $100. It can go quite a way.
Hold
So
on.
every bit of that.
Oh, okay. I figured it out. It was playing on one of my other windows. Okay. All right. We're good. We're good.
Okay. But yeah,
Beautiful.
as we're saying, as we were saying, check out Serpentine Expeditions. They got some really great trips coming up in the next year or so. I know they got one. Well, Suriname's already booked up, but they still have open slots for Komodo, not the tooth and claw one. They have still have slots for India. What was the one in Zimbabwe in Africa? Was it Zimbabwe? I think it was
Could be.
Zimbabwe.
I haven't checked their website in a while, so I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, go ahead, check out Serpentine Expeditions. Great company, ethical herping. And like I said, use our code. I mean, hopefully the code is live. It might still be a little coding error still worked out, but hopefully the code is live and you can get $100 off with code CK25. So go ahead and check them out.
Yeah, I mean, we could both stand by it that very reputable people behind Serpentine, so you don't want to miss out on any of these trips. So check them out. Use the code. Rock on.
Right. So Bryant, you want to be the one to introduce our guest for the night?
Well, I mean, just before, I was curious, any other housekeeping? Any updates with you? I know we talked on some of your additions to your collection, like the scrubby, and
I might have to talk about subtraction or two, but my
Hey.
first snake I ever had passed away the other day, unfortunately. So,
Oh,
oh no, the
sorry
carpet
about that.
or
Yeah,
oh bummer, dude. You've had her for a while, right?
I've had him since 2018.
Man.
Oh, that sucks, man.
Yeah.
Condolences.
Oh, well.
Well, on that somber note, yes, I yeah. We like I said earlier, we are graced today by Eric. How do you say your last name,
A
my friend?
Rosenthal.
Rosenthal.
Yeah.
I guess I don't. I just to give a bit of context, we've been following each other's account for quite some time,
Yeah.
and I've also followed you on the YouTubes. We can dive all into that later, but you've done quite a bit, my friend.
A little bit.
Clearly, you're one of those guests that we like to have on. Obviously, you've put the mileage. You've done the hard work, and I mean, as we'll dive a little later into this chat, herps are really just it's like 360 in your life, isn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, I don't know who I'd be without it, that is for sure. So
And so that kind of opens the discussion. Was this always a fascination with you? Just kind of how did you start with herps?
Yeah. So basically my obsession with snakes started when I was 7, and I used to live in San Antonio with my parents when I was a kid, and we had moved. I wasn't into herping back then, but we moved to Tennessee, to Memphis, after my dad got a new job, and we moved to this property that had 2 acres of oak hickory forest, basically. And I knew snakes were a thing. I didn't really like, I wasn't fascinated by them or anything like that. I had always known they were a thing, but one day I was riding my bike around my backyard as a little 7-year-old, as they do, right? And there was a baby gray rat snake just sitting on one of our windowsills, and I don't know what happened. Like, something in my brain just clicked the second I saw that snake. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like the coolest thing ever. Cause I didn't realize that you can find snakes where you live. I always pictured in my little kid head at the time that it was, you know, you had to go travel the world to see snakes, you know, go to Africa and, you know, Arizona and stuff like that. But ever since I started realizing that they're all around us, and no matter where you live, practically, there's usually going to be some snake species there. At it just started when I was 7, and I have been doing it ever since. So,
no, I mean, real solid, and you're right, man. I mean, they can be quite abundant and all around us. You just kind of got to have that extra keen sense about you.
Exactly.
You know, I didn't know you had your roots in Texas. I thought you were a Tennessee boy.
Yeah, well, Tennessee is definitely. I was actually just talking to one of my friends about this yesterday. Tennessee will always be home to me, I think. You know, I miss it all the time. And, you know, I still go back and visit. I just had an amazing trip back there and Kentucky earlier this May. And we found so much stuff. But, yeah, you know, I'll always be a Tennessee guy. But, yeah, I do, in fact, live in Texas now. So it's a bit of a shift.
So don't mind him dipping out. He has a bit of a power outage in his area.
Wow. Yeah, that's all good.
It's funny, you know, a couple weekends ago, Nate and I were actually down in Southeast Texas, kind of, you know, what is it, Beaumont, like Angleton area.
Yeah.
We went to Crocodile Encounters. If you've heard of it,
I haven't been there yet, but I've heard of it. Yeah.
Solid place to go, my friend. And they hosted CrocFest for the first time in Texas, because usually it's in a Florida facility, since, you know, Florida's pretty adequate for keeping crocodilians. But it was fantastic, man. But yeah, the humidity, oh my god, man.
Yeah.
you don't get used to it.
Coastal Texas, my friend.
it was amazing, but yeah, you don't get used to it. I remember we got bitten up, absolutely destroyed by mozzies for like just one rodeo. And I told Nate, I was like, man, I hope we didn't get bitten up for just one water snake.
Was that all y'all got?
For that night. I mean, we were only there for like a day and a half. And then the next day we did get a copperhead and some more Nerodia and a lifer for the both of us.
What would you say was the most notable thing that y'all found? Or the most exciting?
I mean, everything was kind of new for me besides the broad banded and the erythrogaster. We got our life for Eastern mud turtle, which
nice. Yeah. Cool. I would get Eastern muds in West Tennessee a decent bit back when I lived there. I haven't seen one of them here yet. I have seen a decent amount of musk turtles, though. I just haven't seen a mud yet here. So,
yeah, we have them here in Illinois. I'm from Illinois, and so we get them in southern Illinois, but I've only seen desiccated ones, sadly. So it was great. And then I also got, you know, my textbook southern, you know, copperhead. I'll still call them that.
The ones that we get in the piney woods are, at least to me, I've talked to some other people about this and they seem to agree, but they seem to be exceptionally light colored out here. I think it has to mostly do with the amount of sand that we have. But you know, a copperhead's in most places already a pretty tan colored snake anyway, but the ones in the piney woods are exceptionally vibrant, I think. So
tan, and just, you know, they're super versatile, variable species. I love copperheads.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I found how many did I cruise? 3. I was out cruising last night and I got 3. They if you're out cruising in this area, they're by far the most common species that you're gonna get. Oh man, that's spooky.
Sorry, it's power outage in my place. I had to switch over. So
no, you're good.
I'll probably just go cameraless for now.
You're all good. You're all
no
good.
Worries, my friend. That's definitely not a brownout for sure. So I guess at this point in the season, is there, you know, most Texan herpers I talk about, they say there's a specific window when it comes to road cruising. Do you you follow this as well? You know.
So I've been here for about 2 years now. What I've noticed so far is that usually around April, May is when it depends if you're trying to do night cruising or day cruising. Like typically April and May, as is most types of herping, at least in temperate areas like where we are now, seems to be pretty good. As long as you're getting nighttime temperatures in the mid 70s and up to about 80, usually if you get past, and I'm sure you probably already know this with your experience, but whenever you start getting past 80 degrees, at least in my experience, it stops, like the productivity typically drops after that, at least when it comes to diversity. You'll still get things like copperheads and rat snakes, some of your more common and more dense species. But if you're trying to get things like corals, you know, timbers, which timbers are still, you know, you can get them in a slightly more hot nights. But yeah, you know, typically those hotter nights are usually going to get the more common species. But April, May, early summer, late spring is usually when I have the best success with cruising.
Sure,
out here.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, out here in the Midwest, you know, there's only specific pockets that you can be at to actually, you know, have success road cruising and whatnot.
Yeah, well, I mean, the nice thing about here is that it's so warm that, I mean, you can really herp year-round. Like, you can find snakes year-round out here pretty much. Like, I was finding hognose snakes last year in January and February, which, you know, back in Tennessee, that would have been, like, you know, a crazy thing to happen. But out here, yeah, I mean, you can find snakes pretty much year-round, which is sick. So it's honestly, it's funny, like, I would prefer finding stuff in the winter out here as opposed to the summer, which is the opposite, you know, like back where I was from in Tennessee, even though the summers were still hot in Tennessee, don't get me wrong, the winters were cold enough on average that, you know, you still wouldn't really get much at those times of year. But out here, it's a little bit different. So it's pretty cool. It's a good adjustment, I would say.
Yeah, it's an interesting changeup. You know, speaking on Tennessee, how is it to herp Tennessee? You know, I think I've only slightly been in Tennessee once while going to the Smokies.
Yeah, but, yeah. Smokies are great. Yeah, it's
that, I mean, yeah, just kind of give us a bit of a clue on how it is to herp.
Sure, Tennessee. Yeah. I mean, it's well, one of the things that I love about Tennessee is that depending on what side of it you fall on, it's completely different. You know, like if you go, it sounds like you've had experience in the Appalachians. You know, obviously, if you go to the eastern side of the state, you get the Appalachians, you get the Smokies, the really montane high elevation areas. And as you go further west, you get closer and closer to the alluvial floodplain in the Mississippi. And the geology changes drastically from the eastern side to the western side. And with that, you get a bunch of different species that are more, I guess you could say, statewide endemic to certain ecoregions. So like where I was from in West Tennessee, we had certain floodplain specialists like Mississippi green water snakes, cyclopean, mud snakes. Which mud snakes you can get a little bit further east. Yeah, yeah, pull up some pictures, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, that was one of the big things about Tennessee that I liked the most about it was just the variety in geology, the variety in climate. And I've had a decent amount of experience throughout the state. Like I said, my main home base was West Tennessee, but I also worked on the Cumberland Plateau for a summer, which was amazing. I've been to the Smokies, I've been to the Nashville area, the Nashville Basin. So I have a little bit of experience with pretty much every ecoregion out there, and I miss it all the time. It's an amazing state.
No, guys. So to give context, he's being quite humble when he says he has a little bit of experience in Tennessee.
Because,
you know, I've been following your content for so long. I would say you're one of the 10 kings in the herping community.
You know, being too gracious.
there's only a few I would put at that status. Here's Kyle, who's out in Texas too, and then
yeah, did you meet him while you were here?
You know, the first time I was in Texas was back in 21, and I messaged him and Clint a little bit, but no, I never got to meet him in person.
We've been talking about meeting up. I'm hoping that we'll be able to go out and herp around Houston this fall at some point. So hopefully that works out. But so actually this picture, I included this for a specific reason. So you were talking about habitats when we were talking on Instagram, and one of the things that is really interesting about this particular six-lined race runner, it's, you know, to most people, this isn't that notable of a species, right? Well, I mean, it depends on where you're at. Maybe
first off, the fact that you got to sit still for the photo, you know, very, very rarely have I been able to do that. So, very rarely do I find other people that are, that manage to get, you know, species racers and race runners to stay still, even
can,
for a.
It can be tricky. I mean, even just catching them can be a really big struggle. Like I'm trying to do, because I do educational videos for the park I work at right now, and I've done a few on some of the local lizards that we get in this particular area, but I haven't done one on a race runner yet. And I have places where there are populations of them around here, so I'm trying to do the same thing with one of them here. But like you said, catching one is so, you know, not impossibly difficult, but it's very, very difficult. But yeah, like, so this lizard, this is actually a really, I won't like mention exactly where per se, but if you go along the Mississippi River, and this is one of those things that I don't think people will pick up on until you've lived in an area like West Tennessee for a little bit longer. And this doesn't just happen in West Tennessee, but this lizard lived, I hope it still lives there, in a place that is basically a big sand deposit along the Mississippi River. So, you know, essentially what happens is that over the years when major flooding events happen, it carries these giant deposits of sand, and it basically accumulates in areas depending on how the water's flowing. And what will happen is you'll end up getting some of these deposits that stay above the flood line, and you'll actually get more upland open habitat species like six-lined race runners, like hognose snakes, I think scarlet snakes. I never found any out there, but this is just a really good example of how unique the localized habitats can be. And, you know, you're not going to see this on an ecoregion map either. Like, you're not going to notice, like, within the alluvial floodplain that they mentioned this. You have to actually, get out in the habitat yourself to see this.
No, it's definitely more of an equal. It's more of an equal tone, would you say, just because of how small and
it's a more nuanced change in the biome of that area. So, you know, this is a really, really cool spot from back home in West Tennessee that I really, you know, I tried to, like I said, I was mostly interested to see if there were scarlet snakes and glass lizards at these kinds of places that had the sand deposits, but I never got one. But yeah, just another great example of how even in a place where you've lived a long time, you might not find something like this until you've been there for a while. So,
well, that's one of the things I always reiterate when it comes to herping and herpetology in general. It's especially if you go out field herping, it's so novel. Every time you go out, it's novel because you may base your assumptions on what you're going to find and whatnot, but until you have boots on the ground, you don't know for certain what's going to happen.
Exactly. Well, I mean, for example, I thought pygmy rattlesnakes out here in East Texas would be pretty easy. No, no, they're not. Not at all. Like, I was for a long time trying to find a pygmy in Tennessee, and it sucked because I think I was on the year that I was going to end up finding one before I left. And then, you know, I got this new job here. So I was like, but I was like, oh, at least they'll be easier to find in Texas. But that's definitely not the case. This this is actually really cool. So for anybody,
are these crayfish frogs? I didn't mean to cut.
Yeah,
in, but
they're crawfish frogs. So yeah, for anybody watching that isn't aware, these are Lithobates aerialatus. This is the crawfish frog, and these two are in implexus. So you've got a male on top, and you've got a female on the bottom. And this is actually a pretty rare species throughout most of their range because they are a an upland prairie specialist. And as I'm sure a lot of, as I'm sure you and a lot of our viewers know, that this is a type of habitat that is disappearing throughout where they occur, and we have a fraction of what we used to have when it comes to native grassland prairies. And this is actually a very good indicator species that there are remnant prairies around. And in the lowest plain of West Tennessee, where I went to college, there actually were populations of these that were spritzed in the area. And I included this just to show how, you know, you can get something that looks like just an average frog to the general person, but if you really dig into it, you know, you would realize that this was actually a pretty rare and specialized species. So
no, they're special frogs. And obviously with a name moniker like what is it, Snoring Thunder, I mean, you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, we get them in the southern till plains of southern
Illinois. Yeah, I was going to say, do you see them in Illinois at all?
There's a lot of cross reference with species from Tennessee to Illinois. Yeah, we do get them, and I've only seen the ORs and I've heard them, but I haven't seen a live one in hand. But no, they're awesome amphibians. We've been a little amphibian lackluster lately on the podcast, so it's nice that you're refreshing us with like incredible species like this.
Absolutely, this this is Well, I've seen records of them because when I was trying to learn more about how they worked in Tennessee, I was there was more information on them in southern Illinois. And then also, I believe, Indiana, there was some good records and good information from those state agencies out there. And these frogs that you're looking at here, and this is something that I really encourage every newer herper to try and get to the point where you're doing eventually, is get with your state wildlife agencies and get with your local colleges that have herpetological programs going on and try to figure out if your state has any kind of database or an atlas or something like that, that if you find something that's more notable to conservation, like, you know, in the case of crawfish frogs, that you can submit your findings to. And that way, you know, it's citizen science, you know, we can all make a difference in conservation that way. And these two frogs are actually now in the Herp Atlas for Tennessee. So, you know, they hopefully will be ambassadors for their species. So,
very sweet, man. That's awesome. And key point on the Atlas. Nowadays, most states have a Herp Atlas database, but again, we have 50 states, so who knows? But most, for the most part, have that. So, really cool, dude. Really cool. And this guy, oh my gosh, is this a grotto
salamander? It's not. I've looked for grotto salamanders in Arkansas before. I did not find one, unfortunately. This is actually a Tennessee cave salamander. So this is a species that I found when I was doing my internship with Tennessee State Parks at South Cumberland State Park. I won't mention the name of the cave, just, you know, because it's a sensitive species. But we had caves all up and down the Cumberland Plateau. There's caves that, you know, if you find the right setting within the caves, they can hold the right conditions for these salamanders to thrive. And I actually found a fair amount of these while I was working out there. And what's interesting about these, at least in my experience so far, is that you're not always going to find them in just any body of water within a cave that you're spelunking or just exploring. Like you're going to need to look for, and like I said, this is in my experience, maybe there's other people that have found them in other ways, but you need to find areas that aren't as full of sediment. So like running water, for example, that's carrying a bunch of sediment in it. You know, taking oxygen out of the water. You're not normally, at least like I said, in my experience, going to find these. You need to find places where the groundwater is actually coming up and the water's clear, there's not as much sediment, and that's exactly how I would find these when I was out there. They're incredible salamanders because you're in this place that's just completely pitch black if you turn your light off, and it's pretty cold, you know, you don't think much life would be there, yet these, you know, these animals have been molded over millions of years to specifically live in this place that you might not expect anything to be alive in to begin with, so, you know, they're amazing animals.
And, you know, they're still Eurasia, aren't they?
Yes. Yes, they are actually. Yeah, no, they I don't remember their specific epithet, but they actually are in the Eurasia genus, which I, when I first learned that, I was very surprised because they don't, you know, to me at least, they don't look like a three lined or a long tail or something like that.
No, but it's like you said, as evolutionists kind of molded them to fit a specific type of environment, you can kind of see how they became kind of bland. I mean, very cool, but
I mean, like it's they're certainly not as colorful as a long tail or most of the other Eurasia, but regardless, just the fact that you're finding them where you're finding them and there's anything even there to begin with is amazing. But yeah, I still haven't seen a grotto salamander yet because they're another, a troglobite species. Yeah, I think that's the proper term for it. But yeah, I've looked for grotto salamanders. I've looked for Texas blind salamanders in the past. So, you know, I'm trying to knock off some of those other troglobite species. Is it troglodyte or troglobite? I'm blanking on that right now. Do you know?
I'm blanking too. I feel like it's...
I think it's... I've heard troglodyte before, but I don't know.
I think it's troglodyte. Somebody will have to fact check us on that. But
well, I've only ever heard it...
in caves. So.
I've only ever heard it used in terms of someone who's like a knuckle dragger or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an amazing salamander, yeah.
Well, you got to wonder how slow a metabolism for this kind of critter would be, you know?
Yeah, and another cool thing is that you can typically find these year-round. Like, I found them not when I was working at this place, but I visited again back, I think it was in January at one point. And yeah, even in the dead of winter, you could go into these caves because, you know, the temperature stays fairly similar year round. So you could actually go in the winter and find them. You could go in the middle of the summer and find them. So one of my favorite things to do was, you know, when it was blazing hot in like, you know, July, August, and, you know, I wasn't really finding many snakes, it was really great to go and, you know, see these guys because they could still be active at those hot times.
Yeah. I mean, who wouldn't want to go spelunking in summertime, you know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things about the Cumberland Plateau that, is definitely lacking here is clear water that's spring fed. We do have spring fed water around here, but it's nothing like it was at you know, at the Cumberland Plateau. It's very sedimenty here, very murky, but that's cool in its own accord.
Well, also just ease of access, because just because I've said before, and it, I mean, Texas is huge, so you got a lot of land to cover above and underground.
Mm-hmm. A lot of private land.
Yeah, no, you're right. Like you don't even have to be, you know, like I was on a public road one time, not terribly long ago. There are some interesting people out here. There was one dude that like, they take their private land very seriously out here. I wasn't even on anyone's private land. And some dude on a public road, like was yelling at me just for driving on a road. And I was like, dude, whew. So, but
if you had a light bar on, go for it, Nick.
Yeah, well, I didn't even have a light bar or anything like that. I was just driving my truck around. So, yeah, if any of you come out to Texas, be careful about some of the private property owners. They can be crazy, which is, you know, the case for pretty much everywhere, depending on where you're at. But I've already had some fun experiences when I wasn't even trespassing. So
I was going to say, you ever get the classic, your best get a stepping boy? Or...
No, nobody's pulled a gun on me yet, thankfully. I'm hoping that doesn't happen, but, you know, this one instance that I'm, talking about, I would not have been shocked if, you know, if I hadn't handled it in a calm manner as I did, I can imagine that would have probably happened. So,
yeah, there's one thing about Texas, every land's private. On every private land, it's a firearm somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's got guns out here. That is for sure.
Yeah. But what's a more disarming comment than just saying, just trying to look for snakes, dude.
Yeah, you know? No, I mean, like it. I think what he might have thought, because I had roofing tin in the bed of my truck to, you know, put out to find snakes with, and I think the guy might have thought that I was like littering on his land or something like that, which I wasn't. But like, there's some of the rural people out here can be. Some of them can be very nice. Some of them can be very hospitable and very kind. But it's just like any. A group of humans, you want to be careful. There's always some crazy ones out there, so you know, you don't want to get yourself hurt, that is for sure.
And so you've touched on something that none of the other guests have touched on, which is, you know, tin, you know, artificial cover.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, that's a big thing in the herping communities. And, you know, Nate and I are no strangers to it, but I guess just talk a bit about, you know, your strategy when it comes to, I mean, setting tin down. What's the, what do you call it? What's the discipline of setting tin right?
Yeah. So there, I definitely do believe there's an artistry to it. There's, I don't want to say there's a right and a wrong way to do it. It really just depends on what species that you're looking for. But the things that I would keep in mind, if I'm painting with broad brush strokes here, is make sure that at least in the case of most species, that there's some degree of openness to where you're putting it. So even if you're putting tin in the interior of a forest, make sure that maybe there's a fallen tree that's leaving a hole in the canopy so that sun can come through and hit it at least at some point in the day is a really good thing. So make sure that at least some sun's going to be hitting it at some point during the day. Some people try to make sure that it's just the morning that it's hitting it. Other people don't really care about that as much. And, like I said, it really just depends on what you're targeting. So if you have a site that is getting afternoon sun, for example, that can be good. Maybe when it's, a time of the year, it's going to be warmer at that particular point. So it just depends on what you're trying to get. But either way, make sure your tin is not in an area that is going to be, fully submerged with water at the time of the year when you're going to be trying to get the species that you're getting, which is typically in temperate regions, at least like where we're at now. April, May typically is going to be the best time to flip. Fall can be good, but the precipitation's not as high on average. So you want there to be a good amount of, you want the water table to be high so that it's pushing those fossorial species up towards the surface. So make sure you're putting your stuff in an area that's a little bit more raised up. So at those times in the year when the precipitation levels are higher and you're going to have more success flipping fossorial species, that it's not going to be flooded. That's a big thing that I try to focus on no matter what species I'm trying to get, unless it's like mud snakes, or something.
I was going to say, you're not touching on the aquatics.
If it's something fully aquatic, obviously that's different. You want it to be, honestly, with mud snakes.
Has tin been successful when it's partially submerged?
I've never flipped Francia under tin before, but I've seen other people. I don't know if they actually. Yeah, no. Phil Peak. I don't know if you're familiar with Phil Peak or not. There are some cover sites that he's put out where he was targeting Francia with tin, and he ended up getting some that way. Yeah, typically with Francia, whenever I'm putting cover out for them, I'm using big plywood boards. I wouldn't recommend using chipboards. You can, and I have gotten them under chipboards before, but plywood tends to last longer. Chipboard's very brittle and, fragile in most instances.
After several seasons, usually it's done.
Yeah, And, plywood will deteriorate too eventually. Like, I have sites where I would put plywood out that back in like 2020, and they're all gone and deteriorated at this point.
But again, it just depends on what you alluded to. It just depends on the seasonality of the humidity. Exactly. If there's decent humidity spikes throughout the season, throughout the year, then it's going to disintegrate a lot faster. But if it's in the air region, then maybe not so much.
Yeah, like if you're looking for a species like a scarlet king snake, for example, and it lives in a more xeric area that is a really dry, and you're putting chipboard out for something like that, you can get away with that a little bit easier just because you're not going to get as much water soaking it. And that's the other problem with chipboard I've noticed over the years, is that it retains moisture way too much. If you have, like I said, unless it's a fully aquatic snake like a Francia or like a Liodites, like a swamp snake or something like that, most snakes are not going to want to sit in an area that's wet for too long, because they'll get fungal infections and they'll get all kinds of lesions all over their skin. So with something like chipboard, that's another reason I don't use it, is because it just stays wet. Even at the driest parts of the year, it can usually stay too wet, even if you place it correctly for that. So you always want to keep those things in mind.
Yeah, I mean, if you're an invert nut, then by all means, keep it as it is. Because
you know, absolutely.
Let's touch on this guy a little bit.
Yeah, so this is actually from when I worked on the Cumberland Plateau at South Cumberland State Park in 2021. This is actually a fully in situ picture, and one of the things that I loved the most about the Cumberland Plateau was that the amount of orridus that you would get out there was just insane. I mean, they were more prevalent than pretty much any other place that I'd ever spent a decent amount of time in. And another thing that's interesting about the plateau individuals, at least typically, they're going to be canebrake. They're going to be the canebrake phenotype, and they're not actually going to be the montane timber, like the black and the yellow phase. Because when I was going into it, I thought it was going to be a high enough elevation area that you would get the montane timbers. And there are some places on the plateau that get high enough in elevation where you will start getting the black and the yellow phenotype that you would expect in somewhere like the Smokies. Would you ever find timbers when you were in the Smokies?
I've only been to the Smokies once.
Okay, so you didn't see timbers while you were there, though?
Yeah, I've never seen timbers any times in my... Never seen timbers in all my time in the Smokies.
Yeah, like, but that's one of the things that I thought was pretty cool about the individuals on the Cumberland Plateau is that, you know, even though you're still comparatively from the western side of the state where I spent more time, compared to that, it's a much higher elevation area, but you still tend to get the canebrake phenotype, which for anybody that doesn't know is a more of a lowland color variant of the timber rattlesnake. They used to be a full Atrocodotus subspecies, but they're not recognized taxonomically anymore. But regardless, though, do what?
We won't dive into that yet.
Yeah, I know. I wish they were.
I want to believe.
I know. I wish they were still recognized. But with the plateau, you could literally go. And it's not that you can only do this on the plateau, obviously, but you could literally. What I would do is I would literally just go and walk out in the woods. And I would look for exposed hillsides that had a bit more of an open canopy that was letting more sun in, and you know, maybe there'd be some rock piles, things like that, where they could brumate a little bit more effectively. And I just walk out in the woods, and you know, especially in May, that was usually when I would see them out doing this. They'd just be sitting in ambush, or you know, sitting digesting a meal, or sitting you know, doing whatever they're doing. But that's how I found this snake in this picture. I was just walking through the woods and looking along fallen trees and stump holes and stuff like that. And, you know, it actually would work. You'd find them that way.
And so we can touch on your photography bit a little bit later. But one thing I commend about you is just you have these great in-situs, these great field guide style shots. And like, it's something like this. You remember that old BBC documentary, Life in Cold Blood?
Yeah. It's been a while since I've watched it, but I remember it. Yeah,
it was like a 5-part series on reptiles, and then the snake episode. You know, they were tracking timbers, and I shit you not, man. Like this scene that you took, it's almost identical. It's crazy because the timber was on like a game trail of a rodent or whatever, and eventually.
I love seeing timbers like this is my favorite way to find, I mean, not just Horridus, but pretty much any rattlesnake, especially Horridus, just because I have more experience with them than other croats. But I love finding them like this, where you're just out in their habitat. Like road cruising them's cool, flipping them's cool, like that's awesome, but I feel like nothing, at least for me, beats actually being in the habitat and seeing them in it's called the Reinert position, you know, like when they're sitting at the base of a tree and they have their head propped up waiting for a squirrel to come down the trunk of it, or if they're sitting, like in this guy's case, on the top of a dead log or something like that. It really is an amazing thing to just see them out in their habitat doing what they're doing, not to see them in a road or something like that. So absolutely.
Well, you touched on it, and Nate and I are no strangers out here in the Midwest. Like I said, unless you're in specific regions, road cruising and whatnot, you're not terribly successful. It depends where you are. But I personally love hiking up herps. I mean, that's probably my all-time favorite way of doing it besides flipping. And I mean, you could speak on that. What's your opinions on that? You know, what's your favorite?
Yeah, I mean, it I think it really does just depend, at least for me, it depends on what species that I'm trying to find. So like if I'm trying to get lamps, so like milks and things like that, I have hiked up milks before, but it's nowhere near as effective as something like tin. Like if you want to find milk snakes, you know, I don't want to say that you need to put tin out, but you should. So it's definitely going to be a lot more effective if you do it with that. But yeah, I mean, you know, for something like racers, which, you know, you can still flip racers just fine. But like, you know, if you're trying to get things like racers, coach whips, crotalus, all kinds of different species like that, that are more surface active, you know, more terrestrial. Absolutely. Hiking them up can be just fine. You just have to make sure you time it right and it's not too terribly hot in the middle of the summer. But, you know, that's another note, though. Like, you can... Ah, dang it, I should have included this picture. I have... Depending on what a snake is doing, you can find snakes in certain instances where you wouldn't expect to find them. So, like, if a snake is digesting a really big meal, right... You might be able to find, for example, a timber rattlesnake that's sitting out in 90-plus degree weather in full sun, you know, sitting there digesting its meal because it needs to raise its metabolism and get more energy so that it can digest that big meal. So there are situations where even when it's really, really hot or even when it's colder, too, like if a snake is sick, for example, like my friends and I, we found a rainbow snake in South Carolina or something like that. I don't remember the exact state we were in, but we found a rainbow snake in a setting that was not where like we would normally expect to see one, but the animal was sick, which obviously like we wished it wasn't sick that we when we found it. But you can find snakes when they're sick or they're digesting or they're gestating young or something like that on the more extreme ends of the spectrum when it comes to conditions. So don't just pigeonhole yourself. And I'm more so speaking for people. I know y'all probably know this, but don't just pigeonhole yourself into, oh, it's 75 degrees and cloudy. That's like the only time that I'll go out and look for snakes. Like, you know, still try other stuff. And, you know, you might still find stuff anyway.
And sometimes when you do pigeonhole yourself to like those specific days and temps, you might strike out. That's just kind of the nature of herping.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm actually, I'm reading Phil Peak and Will Bird wrote a book called like The Art to Snake Catching or something like that, or like Snake Hunting Tips or something like that. Are you familiar with that one?
I have not read it, but I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, I actually just recently got it. And, you know, Phil's a guy that I admire a lot. And when it comes to his herping, and he mentioned something just like that in his book where he said that, you know, if you just commit yourself to one particular time, you know, one particular season, not only might you strike out, but you might also just keep saying you might just keep seeing the same individual snakes over and over and over again, which is cool because, you know, like you can see how they're moving. Like if you have a bunch of cover in one area and you're finding this snake here on this day and this snake here on that day, it can be cool to see how far they're moving and what their movement habits are, but you might scare that animal away eventually if you do that, and you won't see the other individuals that live there. So absolutely, you want to switch it up for sure.
Well, you can probably paint a picture with that, you know, with your Tennessee flip sites. You've probably had dozens of recaptured individual snakes.
Yeah, well, I actually did. I did some undergraduate research when I was in UT Martin when I was getting my bachelor's, and a professor of mine sponsored it at the time. And we were basically doing just that. We were comparing the habitat usage between there was like a plot of land that I was doing it on at the university. And we put cover boards out, and there's a nice one. I'll talk about that in a minute. But we put cover boards out along the edge. And then we also put cover boards out in an open portion of a field that would get burned. And we were basically tracking the movement of snakes using the cover boards. You know, obviously, using something like radio telemetry would be more effective for that. But, you know, we didn't have the permits to do something like that. And I didn't have the experience to do surgery on snakes or anything like that. So
it's definitely a bit more invasive.
It's very, it's a lot. I want to do that eventually, but using what we had, we did document, you know, throughout the season, I would see snakes show up in the spring of one year. They would disappear for a few months, and then they would show up at the same exact areas the following year. You know, they do, as I'm sure y'all know, but maybe some of y'all watching don't. Snakes do have sight fidelity, so they'll actually travel a constant path every year. They'll follow a scent trail, so you can have that happen. And that's actually a great segue to this guy. That's something that I did with this snake several times. This is a red milk snake. For anybody that doesn't know, it's they're now eastern milk snakes, but
this Suspilla is forever.
Yeah, no, dude, me too. Rock on. But regardless, though, this is a snake that to this day, I wasn't the one that found it back in May, but somebody else that posted it on Instagram found this snake. I've been finding this snake and seeing records of this snake popping up at a certain site that I won't mention, but since 2021, and it is now 2025, and it is still hanging out in the same areas every single year, which is just amazing. So yeah, you can do that with snakes, absolutely.
That's so awesome, dude. And I mean, who doesn't love a red milk snake? I mean,
oh yeah, no, I mean they're one of my favorites for sure. And that one of the cool things about this particular individual is if you look towards its tail, it has a bit of an aberration, like a little bit of a white aberrant pattern down by its tail that makes it really easy to identify the individual. And so, like I said, I saw somebody on one of their Instagram videos, they found this milk snake, and I recognized the site, and I was like, oh man, great, somebody found my spot. But regardless, they held it up, and I was like, oh, I know that snake. I found that one like five times or more. So it's really cool to see that people are still, you know, to see that those animals are still in those areas. So,
well, it's funny. You can have real discreet board sites, but, you know, it's just like the saying goes, you know, what build it and they will come or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've stumbled upon many flip sites. I was like, cha-ching. But obviously, be respectful and be ethical when you do this, or
exactly,
don't do it at
like
all.
My big thing, you know, like if you're going to, for example, like if you're going to put cover on, say, like public land, which, you know, make sure you have the proper permissions before you do that, obviously. But like if you're going to do something like that, you know, obviously I would get very upset whenever people would leave my stuff messed up, or like they wouldn't put my stacks back the way that it was, and you know, that would upset me. But you know, if I see somebody's cover site, you know, and I just find it while I'm out herping, yeah, I'll peek up underneath it. I'm not going to abuse it or anything like that, but if I happen upon it, sure. And I don't mind it if people do that with my stuff. It's more so just you know, like you said, be respectful, you know, leave no trace. You know, like if you can if you're going to flip somebody's cover and you can tell that you're going to make it easy to for them to tell that you were there, then you're probably doing it wrong. So it's a respect thing at the end of the day. Absolutely.
Well, you know, and this relates back to some of your YouTubes with just this exact scenario. I actually kind of copied from you with some of my flip sites. I would have like a signage that says like do not touch or like do not flip. Just because, you know, I've had instances where there were a-holes that found my site and they just had my shit scattered, for lack of a better term.
My perspective on that has changed a little bit over time. So I still will do that in certain scenarios. Like I did that recently with I was talking to a private property owner not terribly long ago to put out a site for prairie king snakes. And I got the property owner's permission to do it, but their property that I was putting the tin on was literally right next to somebody else's. And I didn't want the people that owned the other property, who I hadn't talked to yet, to see it and think, oh, you know, that's just garbage that is like right on the edge of my land. So I did it in that particular instance because, you know, I figured that it was probably just going to be these private property owners that would see it. And, you know, it wouldn't be a big deal. But in my opinion now, I would shy away from, you know, like if you're going to put tin in an area that more people might see it, you know, typically speaking, if people are going to be jerks, they're going to be jerks. And that might actually incentivize them to mess with it even more, you know, because they know that, you know, you don't want it being messed with, because that's just the psychology of some of these people. So you gotta, you know, use your own discretion, you know, do what you think is the most smart. But, you know, I will still do that in some instances, but not as much as I used to. Uh-oh, I can't hear you. I think your mic is off.
I was just saying, it's a roll of the dice. And for the most part, I haven't found individuals that are like that abrasive to my sites for the most part. And I mean, yeah. You know, I'd rather leave it where it's at. Yeah, you know, I'd rather leave it where it is than move it.
I've had people leave mean notes underneath my stuff. I hope this isn't too graphic for y'all's podcast. I had somebody leave a pair of panties hanging in a tree right above one of my stacks of tin one time. That was the weirdest one I have ever had. So, I mean, I've had some weird stuff happen with my artificial cover sites.
Yeah, at least it wasn't a witch's totem.
I mean, I'm waiting for that one. That one's probably not far behind. But
next YouTube video is just Blair Witch ripoff.
Yeah. You just never know sometimes.
That's the thing with herping. You'll have tons of oddball stories, as I'm sure you've
had. Oh yeah. Well, hey, I wish I could say I wouldn't. I mean, I guess I wouldn't have it any other way. Like you said, it makes for great stories at the end of the day, for sure. So,
yeah, I mean, that kind of leads me into, and you already obviously told us with the panties incident, but what's another, I guess, maybe oddball or just interesting event you've had?
Oh God, geez.
I'm sure you have a myriad of stuff to choose from, but
yeah, I really do. Well, I won't tell that one. That one's a little bit graphic. I had the one recently. This one's more PC, I suppose. One of the things that has amazed me about some of the people around here so far is that, you know, like one thing I'll do whenever I see tin that's laying around on somebody's property or like plywood or something like that, and it looks like it's not being used, I'll knock on their door and ask, like, hey, you know, can I take this and use it for my snake surveys? And I've had several instances out here so far where you will just knock on the door of these people, and rural Texas, like, anybody could be knocking on these people's door. You could be an axe murderer. You could be, you know, the mailman. It could be anybody, right? But you'll knock on these people's door sometimes, and they'll just say, come in. Like, they'll just invite you right into their house. Like, you could be anybody, like I said, and they'll just invite you right in. And I've had that happen two times now with two different people. And, yeah, like, I wouldn't walk all the way, and I'd, like, poke my head in and be like, hi, because you never know. Maybe they're the axe murderer. You never know. So you have to be careful. But that's some of the more interesting human encounters I've had recently, I suppose. So.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the light at the other end of the tunnel is that you make another connection, and you know, you
happened. Yeah, I mean, like I had a guy not terribly long ago. I was putting tin out at the park that I work at, and oh dang it, I shouldn't have mentioned that. Oh well,
just don't say the park's name. Yeah, that's all.
Bleep. No, but like I was putting tin that out at the park, and I ran into this guy, and he thought I was littering. So he like came up to me and he was like, are you littering? And he like had his phone out and everything. And I was like, no, I'm a ranger here. Like, I'm putting tin out for this thing that I'm working on. And what ended up happening is he started off with that energy, but then it completely shifted. And he actually was like, oh, that's actually really cool. Do you want more tin? And I was like, yeah, of course I want more. So this guy set me up with 40 more pieces of tin. Yeah, and like it was really nice tin too. So like, you know, you never know. Like you said, sometimes it can start off being like a bit more of an apprehensive encounter with somebody, and it can completely flip, and maybe you'll end up with like five or six new flip spots out of it. You never know. So,
oh man, you're definitely inspiring me right now, Nate. You got that site up yet? I'm coming.
Are y'all
buddy.
Working on a new one right now?
I mean, I think Nate has collected a bit of tin over the months, and you know, I'm same as you, I'm always searching.
There you go. Construction
zones, what have you. I'm always searching for more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the best ways to find snakes. And yeah. This guy was awesome. This is actually
a prime example. I don't mean to cut you off, but prime example. I mean, like you said, Lampropeltis, definitely they're one of those genuses. Or, I mean, they're one of those genus of snakes that, for the most part, flipping is like one of the best ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, this is actually a great example. Like Caligaster, you can get them. I know a few people that have hiked these up and cruised them, but it really does seem that with things as fossorial as something like a prairie king snake, that putting cover out for them, or, you know, like if you're using box traps and drift fences, things like that, which is a lot more work. And, you know, I'm actually going to hopefully be doing my first box trap pretty soon here. Regardless, like if you're trying to get something like a Caligaster, for example, you don't have to put tin out, but it's way more effective. And this is actually a snake that I found just before I left Tennessee on some private property that I had the owner's permission to look for these guys on. And Tennessee, like I hadn't seen a Caligaster in Tennessee yet. I'd seen them in Kentucky. And I think Kentucky was the only state I had seen them at the time. So I wanted to see a Tennessee individual before I left. And, you know, I talked to some private property owners and they let me look for them on their land. And this is the result of that. So.
Nice, dude. I am a Caligaster fan.
We all get a lot of them in Illinois, don't you?
They range quite a bit. I would say the southern half of the state.
Yeah. So
like, out by me, they're out by me. But again, a very difficult, even more so than like Eastern milks that I have out by me, much more difficult to target.
Do you know, do either of y'all know a guy named Terry Vandeventer by chance?
I do. Yeah. He has a formidable presence on some of the Facebook groups.
He does. Yeah.
Was he the one that was just asking the other day for pictures of dumbasses with dead rattlesnakes in Mississippi?
Yeah, I know he was. Yeah, well, he used to live in southern Illinois, and, you know, he would tell me that Caligaster were pretty common up there, and back when he was a kid, he would find them out there pretty often. I've never, most of my experience in southern Illinois is, you know, LaRue Pine Hills, but, you know, I've never gone to some of those more agricultural areas where you would expect to see things like Caligaster as much, so.
Come through, buddy.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
We need you back here.
Absolutely, dude. I'd love to. Yeah, if I ever make my way up there again, I'll hit y'all up for sure. Absolutely.
Because he's not wrong. Like, you know, I haven't seen any live examples of Caligaster in southern Illinois. They've all been DORs, but some of the DORs were giants. I mean, like, there was one.
Yeah, and, you know, I do also think about, you know, I guess you would consider Terry an old timer at this point.
let's be honest. He is up there in age.
Yeah,
so
I love you, Terry, if you're watching this. Terry, he would do snake presentations at Strawberry Plains Audubon Center in North Mississippi for this thing called the Hummingbirds Festival. Oh man, I'm getting into some serious lore here.
I love it. I know what you're talking about.
He would do these really awesome snake presentations at Strawberry Plains. And whenever I was like, you know, 10, as I was starting to get into herping, I was with the Ornithological Society of Memphis at the time too, because I'm also a big bird person. Which is funny, those worlds don't always collide that often. But regardless,
more
though,
than you think.
yeah. I mean, like, you know, birders and herpers like to pick on each other. But regardless, yeah, though, like I would go to this hummingbird festival every fall, and I would watch his programs. I go to every single one. I like talk to him at the end of it every single time for like over an hour, and he was nice enough to talk to me. And that's kind of how our relationship started, and we still we still talk on the phone every once in a while today. But I do wonder, back when he was younger and getting them in southern Illinois, whether the population densities back then have changed compared to what y'all are seeing now, because that's something that anecdotally, I suppose, but people that were older that lived in Southwest Tennessee would always tell me that, you know, hognose snakes, for example, back when they were younger, they were a lot more common, and now they never see them hardly at all. And I can certainly say that with my experience nowadays with them, because, you know, I've only ever gotten a handful of them in my experience in Southwest Tennessee. So I certainly think time and habitat change definitely affects that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely one of the many subjects regarding just herps in general that we think about, you know, like, oh, to be born, you know, back then in the good old days, yep. They say, before yep. They knew they were the good old days.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, one of the big things that I was trying to see before I left Tennessee was a Kirtland snake, which is actually one of the, as far as the amount of records go that exist in the state, they were the least documented species in the entire state. And, you know, I was trying to find them for a little bit. And I talked to some other people, Dave Freimier, for example, who had more experience with them when, you know, he was a little bit younger. And I probably wasn't even into herping it. No, I was into herping at that point. Yeah. But regardless, he would find them back when the habitat was still in its early successional stages, when it was more open and more conducive for those species. But as time has gone on and I started looking for them, a lot of those places that he used to find them grew in, and the habitat changed. And, you know, even though it was still the same place, because it changed, you know, the snakes were nowhere near as detectable as they used to be. So that's another big, you know, we can get into habitat management all day, but yeah, like regardless, it's a big thing to keep them around.
You bring up an interesting point. Like, what if disregarding our human alterations to habitat and whatnot, what if, you know, the specific kind of habitats that Kirtlands use, what if over time, you know, succession happens, and then what, do their populations just get smaller and smaller until they blink out, or does
That's what seems to happen. Yeah. Like I've talked to other people that have more experience with them, and, you know, just in my experience with others. Well, you know, like I've had this same thing happen with corn snakes, for example. Like I had a site, because, you know, typically corn snakes are going to be more of an open habitat species that, you know, they tend to like that setting a little bit more. And I had a site that I would find corn snakes in a while ago, back in like 2019, and back then the habitat was much more open. There was a lot more grasses, and over time, you know, the habitat didn't get managed, so that got filled in. And you know, I visited that site a decent amount since, and, you know, I've not gotten a single corn snake. Now, does that mean they're completely gone? You know, we'll never know for sure, because how secretive they are, it's obviously not as easy to tell these things as something like a white-tailed deer, like some of these larger animals that aren't as secretive. But that's what seems to happen over the years with those species that rely on open habitats, is if you don't manage it, they'll just fizzle out, and they'll go and look for other open habitats. And if they don't find them, you know, maybe they might get hit by a car. You know, there's all kinds of things that can happen to them. So
and then become relictual, you know.
And
also, people also have this misconception about the eastern United States should basically just be a solid forest almost in popular imagination. Whereas historically, natural habitats, there's a lot of natural, like, more open grassland, especially in, like, say, western Tennessee, southwest Ohio, of course, Illinois, the prairie state.
Yeah, I mean, back when bison were still around, they, you know, would graze that stuff, and they were basically the also Native Americans would burn too. So, I mean, there were definitely species and humans at that time that would manage it as well. And fire suppression kind of screwed all that up. But
but here in the eastern U.S., it seems like there's like a slightly misguided concept to conservation, where it's just plant trees.
I'm right there with you. Yeah.
Not plants what the native flora is.
Yeah.
Now, well, I met my cousin who's a botanist. He goes crazy about this sort of stuff all the time. That's his tism. So he's all about like rare species, grasslands, natural forests, all that stuff. He hates lawns, like any good naturalist does. So
absolutely, preach.
100%.
Yes. Yeah. Well, yes. That's actually funny you mentioned that, because, you know, growing up in Memphis, actually, like I would there were a few. When was this? This was when I was in scouts, and I was trying to get like service hours for a merit badge or a rank that I was working on. And one of the big things that I would do to get those hours is I would do tree plantings at this place called Shelby Farms, which is like a city park. And you know, I thought that was like all great back then. And like, I look at it now and I was like, man, I kind of wish that, you know, we didn't plant all those trees. Because, you know, like historically where we were planting these trees, there were, you know, the habitats were more glade-like. They were more open and more grassland in nature. So I was like, man, you know, if it got managed for that, you know, maybe we would see more things like corn snakes popping up, for example. And no, we just planted trees in all this area that was nice and open and great habitat for things like that. And not even just with herps, like LeConte sparrows were a big thing back there too. You know, they're more of an open habitat bird, and short-eared owls and things like that. Habitat that's dwindling, like I said, faster than pretty much any other type of habitat, at least in the United States. And yeah, we just screwed it all up planting all these trees. So I'm right
there.
Yeah.
In my particular neck of the woods, back in the 1930s, a lot of the area around me, which was originally farmland, was replanted as forest, mostly to counteract the high degree of erosion that was going on.
Yep.
But there's so little grassland. There's only like one small local park that is actually maintained as grassland. And it's literally the only place I can think of where you could go to consistently see eastern meadowlark and bobolink and all these more typical grassland birds. Everything else just either farmland or forest.
Yep. Yeah, like the wildlife agency in Tennessee started doing some projects that I was happy about right around the time that I started leaving, where they were managing for not just grasslands, but more open canopied pine forests and oak savannas, places like that, that had more open habitat to them. And I was very happy to see that because, yeah, I think Illinois with Belleville Prairie, they just lost. Well, y'all should. Do you know about
Belleville? Yeah. That was a tragedy.
Was that the last natural remnant prairie, or was it the second to last? I forget.
I believe it was one of, if not the last remaining track of native, you know, prairie in the state. They paved it over for an airport,
right? Yeah. It's crazy.
Freaking Aldo Leopold, part of his legacy was in that prairie, and, you know, they just kind of stomped it out, you know?
Yeah, and there were, if I'm remembering correctly, there were federally protected species in there too, weren't there? Like, wasn't there a bumblebee species in there that was federally protected that they...
I don't doubt it. That place was like about 2.5 hours north of me, but I don't doubt it.
Yeah.
I mean, why would you even build an airport there? Just... literally no place to fly into Illinois worth flying to other than Chicago, right? Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's Rockford, but yeah, O'Hare is the main place. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, who
wants to go to Effingham for vacation? Am I right?
I don't know where that is, but if it's in North Illinois, I'd imagine it's probably not the most forest. So
Central Illinois, but.
Yeah, and to preface, you know, I'm not sure, is Tennessee considered a Midwestern state or is it a Southern state?
Oh, it's a Southern state.
No, I don't believe
it's like it's like a Southern. Midwest. No,
yeah, it would be considered a Southeastern state, not Midwest. Yeah.
Yeah, I was gonna say if Kentucky's a Southern state, then Tennessee has to be a Southern state.
Yeah, for example, look at like the snakes of the Southeast field guide with Whit Gibbons and Mike Dorcas, for example, like that book where they're labeling the Southeastern United States, Tennessee is in that. So yeah, if I'm going by that book, at least it would be considered the Southeastern United States. I've never seen it considered Midwest. No.
Okay. I think I brought this up just because, you know, we all share relatively similar ecoregions and, you know, all three of our respective states, you know, they're doing decent restoration work, even here in Illinois, even with you know, some of the backtracks that we talked about. But, you know, it makes me wonder in, you know, 200 500 years time, what's it all going to look like?
Yeah, well, I mean, it I think about this a lot, or like, you know, not as much as I used to when I lived in Tennessee, but
obviously right now it's tough to be optimistic regarding public
land. There's a region in Tennessee called the Lowest Plain. That's, like I said, where I used to go to college. And historically, that area used to be vast expanses of upland grasslands between the Highland Rim and the Bluff Hills. And I would always think, like, man, what did this look like hundreds of years ago before we brought agriculture in? And like a lot of those species that, and you know, I don't want to necessarily say that agriculture completely ruins all of the species diversity. I certainly think that it affects it. In some cases, agriculture seems to actually be beneficial to things like Caligaster, because it's clearing out areas that were once forested, and they can actually they can maintain strongholds in those agricultural areas. So it seems to actually benefit some species. Not that, you know, that justifies destroying habitat necessarily, but regardless, though, yeah, I would always wonder all the time, like, you know, what did it look like before, you know, agriculture came by? It must have just been, like they said, seas of grass. And I mean, maybe it would have looked like the Great Plains out west or something like that. So, you know, that was something that I always would love to experience, but probably never will. So,
yeah. So in Ohio, the state bird is the northern cardinal, which is kind of funny because if you know anything about cardinals, they're edge habitat species. They're edge habitat specialists.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, before Europeans really arrived in the Ohio country, you only found them in like southwest part of the state along the Ohio River, which is where you get more like the more open oak savanna habitat.
Mm-hmm.
But when Europeans showed up and started opening up the habitat, started opening up for agriculture stuff, that guess what? Cardinals just exploded in their range and population here in the state. Yeah. Just because it changed the habitat into a more open edge habitat, a lot more open edge habitat.
Exactly. Yeah. Like a lot of the times we might have things that, we think of as bad, right? Like, you know, at the end of the day, good and bad is highly subjective depending on what you're wanting to achieve. And, that's the other thing, like, as I'm still obviously very young, but, you know, like, as I'm getting older, I'm recognizing that, we need agriculture, we need farming as the human species. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, necessarily dog on that as a whole, because, you know, at the end of the day, I think conservation as a whole is a delicate balancing act that we need to play to where we're still having all of our base needs met. But we can at least still, you know, appreciate and enjoy the biodiversity in a way that makes both of those worlds at least decently happy. So, you know, it's definitely a balancing act at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. It's a give and a take.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we still got a bit of time on the docket. I did want to jump in a little bit of this East Texas folder you had.
Yeah, sure.
Just to see a bit.
Let me see. Absolutely.
And why not start with an awesome species like this guy?
Yeah, here. I was hoping you'd start with that one. No, that one of the big things that I was the most excited about when it came to moving to East Texas was finding coral snakes because like I said, when I lived in San Antonio, when I was a kid, I wasn't into snakes yet, but whenever I moved to Tennessee and I got into snakes and herpetology, my parents and my family and I would visit San Antonio usually about twice a year for up until COVID happened, actually. And every time we would go to San Antonio, I would be looking for one of my biggest targets was coral snakes. And I never found one in any of those visits that I ended up taking to the Hill Country. So I got really excited when, you know, I learned that I was going to be moving here because I was like, man, I can put a little bit more effort into this old goal of mine and check this off the list. And I found like, I don't know, 6-7 coral snakes so far since I've been here, which has been great. And like literally they live like 10 minutes from me, which is insane. I can literally just hop in my truck. I do this almost every night when the conditions are at least decent. Like I'll just hop in my truck, like go cruise a few back roads. And, you know, sometimes you'll get coral snakes. Sometimes you'll get rattlesnakes. It's crazy. Like, it's a really, really cool part of the country. But, yeah, the coral snakes out here are really, really awesome. I love them.
That's so cool, dude. It seems like of the three we have in the States, it seems like tenor is like, I mean, some could argue with fulvius, right? But tenor seems to be pretty common.
Yeah, I mean, so far in my observations, they have been. I would need more time. I haven't found fulvius yet. I've looked for them in Apalachicola and some of the more panhandle regions of. Yeah, there's another one.
Coral snake. So you're a true Smitty in that regard.
They're a what?
It's a little, if you follow the Inside Culture podcast, it the joke will make sense.
Okay. Yeah, no, that try this is by far my favorite photograph I've ever gotten of a coral snake, because you know, if you're posing a coral snake for pictures, they're not necessarily, yeah, like y'all have, I take it, had experience doing that. They're not an easy snake to photograph by any stretch of the imagination. I've gotten better at it. I don't pose every single one that I find, but regardless, like the ones that I have, I've figured out what I typically do is like I'll carry a plate, like a dinner plate, or like a yep, lid yeah. something with me. Yeah, I'm sure y'all have probably done something like this. And yeah. Like you can get like a rock and you can prop the dinner plate up with like a little pebble or a rock, and you can like let them crawl up underneath it. And then once they're in the hollow portion of the plate, you can pull the rock out and let it sit there for a minute. And you know, after they've settled down, you know, you've lift it up and you know, you get your pictures and that's yeah. that. But this is by far my favorite picture that I've ever gotten of any of the coral snakes that I found out here so far. And it's not every day that and I've talked to other people about this that have more experience with tenor than I do. And, you know, they've said the same thing, that it's a very difficult species to photograph in a lot of cases.
Yeah, man. Yeah, kudos to the photo.
So the only coral snake species I ever photographed was Muscitensis, so the Costa Rican corals.
Nice. Yeah.
And I, like I said, you had to find some way to provide cover that they're not constantly flipping out. But like, also, you had to make sure there's like no little holes or anything like that they can dive down. Because once they get their head in little crevices, they're gone. They're submarine.
Gone. Yeah. Yeah. I almost had that happen with a milk snake one time, actually, that I was photographing, which would have been heartbreaking if it had actually happened. But
yeah,
I know some people that has happened to. Yeah.
But I was going to say, I noticed with Muscitensis, same thing with these tenor, is even on the red portions of the body, the tips of the red scales also have a bit of black on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that, you know, like I said, I've never seen a fulvius. I'd love to at some point, but that's one of the things that I love about the tenor, is that they have a lot more black typically. You know, from pictures that I've seen, you can still get fulvius that have black on the red between the yellow bands. But that is one thing about tenor that I really appreciate, is the prominence, the consistent prominence of black that they have on the red bands. It makes them a little more unique.
Good stuff, man. Sweet deal. Yeah, I unfortunately have lucked out on corals, kind of similar to Nate. You know, I've been to Mexico and Latin America.
Yeah, no, I was actually, I wanted to ask you about some of your Mexico adventures. What was it? Was it Oaxaca? Is that correct?
Oaxaca.
Yeah, I'm terrible with pronouncing these things. Oaxaca, is that how you pronounce it?
It's like a Oaxaca. Oaxaca.
Okay, there we go. How were your experiences there?
Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse, because, you know, Nate and I have talked about those trips of mine so much, but fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
Eight out of 10, because it's a relatively safe state to travel to in Mexico, and herpetofauna is so rich. And, you know, I have a decent, what do you call it, local contact base there now with so I mean, it's tight. I love it.
Yeah, I want to do a Mexico trip at some point. Where was it that I was eyeballing? I can't remember the place that I was specifically looking for. It was actually a more rainforest region.
Yucatan? Like,
where?
Yucatan?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, it's been a while since I've looked into it, but for a while I had a little trip planned out there that was tentative and fell through. But yeah, I want to get out to Mexico at some point. I have probably the craziest place I've been so far was the Galapagos Islands, which I still can't even believe that I had the chance to go there. That's by far, I think, the craziest trip I've been on. So
you know what, I want to save Nate the trouble of not being somewhere where there's no AC at the moment. I'll call you out, Nate. But, you know.
Hey. I knew I should have texted you that.
But, you know, I want to be conscientious of your guys' time. So why not we dive into your Galapagos trip a little bit? Because I know you shared some snippets.
Yeah, I've got some pictures if you want to pull them up. Absolutely, yeah.
Let's do that. That's insane. Because I mean, that's the place where what? The theory of evolution, right? Or speciation. Yeah, Darwin.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know what's funny is everyone brings up the finches in the Galapagos. Darwin never wrote about it. It was like scientists back in like the 1940s who first mentioned the finches.
Yeah. Well, I got to visit the Charles Darwin Research Center down there on oh goodness, what was the name of that island? It was
Santa Cruz or
Santa Cruz. Yeah, it was Santa Cruz. It was Santa Cruz. And yeah, I got to visit the research station down there, which was really cool. And okay, so I still can't believe that I've actually seen these things in the wild. That's just insane.
A lot of turtles. Yeah,
I do too. Yeah, so these Galapagos giant tortoises, they basically fill in the niche of cows here.
Yeah.
They graze, essentially. Like, you'll find them in fields that you would look at as an American and think, oh, that's a cattle field. But no, instead of cows, it's these gigantic prehistoric tortoises that are just wandering around grazing the grass. And like, they actually will have ponds just like our cattle ponds that we have here in a lot of cases, and they'll be sitting in them bathing and soaking in the mud. At least that's how these individuals were. There were individuals on different islands that didn't behave that way, and depending on what island you're on, they actually are different species too. So this, I forget which exactly what this particular species was called. I don't know. Was it called the Santa Cruz? I don't remember. But regardless though, they were incredible. And like, you can't really tell from this picture, but this tortoise stood, I want to say like 3 foot off the ground, maybe 4. I mean, like, it was,
no, dude, it looks like a certified chunk for sure.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. And, like, that was the thing. Like, when you're in the Galapagos, it was a very strict thing that you couldn't get any closer than 6 feet. So you had to basically pretend that they had COVID, right? But you couldn't get any closer than 6 feet. But even then, sometimes, the tortoises, if you got close enough to them, they might they would get a little nervous that you were near them. And they would rear up and they would like hiss and they would just get so much larger than they already were. And, you know, it was amazing. I still can't believe that I got to experience that. But the marine iguanas were incredible everywhere. Only the coastal regions, though. This is the big thing about the Galapagos. If you're ever trying to go out there and herp, the inland areas of the islands, you can still get the tortoises, but if you want to get things like marine iguanas, land iguanas, which I've put a photo of them in there too, and all of the snakes that live on the islands, you only get them on the coast, and the lava lizards too. So like, most of the herp life in the Galapagos, if you ever visit, it's going to be on the coast. And whenever you do, you'll see tons of marine iguanas, and they'll shoot the salt deposits out of their nostrils, which was crazy. Amazing, amazing animals for sure.
Yeah, I mean, iconic for sure. What sparked this trip for you?
It was a study abroad trip, actually. I was taking my biology 2 class in the junior college at that time. Yeah, the community college that I was going to at the time. I was taking my biology 2 class, so it was a study abroad trip. And yeah, I not only got to get the college credits that I needed, I got to visit the Galapagos while I was doing it. So, I mean, it was amazing. But yeah, this is a really good example of one of the land iguanas. And even though they're still the land iguana, you still also get them a lot of the times in the more coastal areas. But they're a bit more of a, like, so in the Galapagos, you'll get rainforests, actually. And some of the islands have a little bit more of like a desert climate, you know, like a desert habitat to them. And that's typically where you would find the land iguanas, were in these more dry, desert-like habitats. But sometimes you could still see them on the coast too, when they butted up next to those desert type areas. So really, really cool.
Yeah, they look like heifers too. I mean,
kind yeah, of yeah, they were huge. Like, they were, on average, I would say they were even bigger than the marine iguanas, which was insane because they were already pretty big too.
Yeah, but it's interesting with them that, you know, you can only get so big from eating algae. And then obviously there was like those studies that show that, you know, in times of hardship, right, they would actually shrink.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like it.
A vertebrate that shrinks.
Yeah, like and you know, you can find pretty decent densities of them too. Like with the marine iguanas, you didn't necessarily see it in that particular picture. But when you were in areas that had marine iguanas and land iguanas, you had them. Like you would get dozens of them sometimes in just one condensed area where the conditions were right. And it was the same thing with these land iguanas. Like we were on one island, and it was North Seymour. I don't think that's a very secret thing. I think everybody local to that area knows that. But regardless, though, we would see just tons of these land iguanas as we were hiking throughout this this island. And still can't believe I got to do it. It was amazing.
Man, awesome. You're making me regret passing up on the Galapagos trip I didn't take.
Oh, were you about to and you turned it down, or what happened?
Basically, it was summer 2019. It was right after I got done with my Crocodile Encounter internship. My aunt and uncle were doing an Ecuador trip, including a trip to the Galapagos. And they invited me to go along with them, but I just didn't have the money. And I just didn't have the money at the time, and also I couldn't get my passport soon enough to go. So I was like, "Ah, man."
Well, yeah, we stayed in Quito. We were supposed to stay in Quito for one night, and I was so excited because I was like, man, you know, I'll get to whenever we stay at the hotel that we're going to stay at. It actually butted right up against the rainforest in Quito. And it's like, man, you know, for that one night, I'm going to stay up all night. I don't care. I'm going to stay up all night, and I'm going to shine around the rainforests that are right by the hotel. And unfortunately, we were stuck in the airport for the entire night instead, and I didn't get to do it. And it was terrible because, like, the Quito airport, I don't know if either of y'all have been to it, but they have these this giant window that you look through and you can just see the Andes right there. And it's incredible. So like the whole time that I was in the airport, you know, knowing that originally we were going to be out there, I just was looking at it and I was like, oh, I can't.
Well, I don't want to rub salt on your wounds, but, you know, Nate and I recently did a trip to Colombia. And so we passed through the Andes, and we were in some of the associated regions. But, you know, this kind of brings up another point. Would you want to go back to Ecuador again, excluding Galapagos and like Ecuador
Absolutely,
proper?
Yeah. I'm actually planning on going to Australia with some of my friends, hopefully next year. And but yeah, definitely I want to go to Ecuador at some point. There's also it's a trip to, I want to say, yeah, it's Peru. I'm pretty sure there's a pretty popular one that Mike Pingleton does. Do y'all know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah. The one into a research station in Amazonian Ecuador.
Yeah. I want to go to that one at some point. One of my buddies, Lucas Dunn. I don't know if y'all know Lucas or not. Do y'all know him?
Sounds familiar. Maybe on Instagram.
Yeah, he went and did it, and he you know, he had really great things to say about it, and he brought back a lot of amazing pictures and everything. But yeah, I'm definitely at some point wanting to get out into the Amazon before it's you know, all gone. So
still, man, Australia, that's freaking awesome. And that kind of
we're planning on going to the Red Center, actually, and we're gonna hopefully get taipans and you know, black-headed pythons and all kinds of really cool stuff like that. So I'm still not 100% sure that I'm gonna be able to do it, but I'm working on it. So hopefully that ends up happening.
So Bryant, does that inspire you to do any trans-Pacific trips?
You keep beating around this bush, Nate. Yes, it does. But I still want to explore that South American cap, man. I mean,
yeah. Well, it's tough. South America is so much closer. We could always go any other time. So
as long as see a Bushmaster of some kind before I die, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Preferably a black-headed, but any Bushmaster before I die, and I'm happy. So
we'll do. Well, I mean, you know, Nate went to Costa Rica and he's seen the eyelash vipers, which are just, again, another iconic group of vipers too.
Yeah, that's I had a little Costa Rica trip planned for a little bit that we were supposed to do. Actually, I think it was next month that we were originally going to do it. That fell through. But I was mostly going to be looking for things like eyelash vipers. But I mean, because that's the thing. It's like, obviously, there's so many things to see in a place like Costa Rica. But even though that's the case, I'm honestly more interested in seeing the more common things like eyelash vipers, like Fertilance, red-eyed tree frogs, just because they're so iconic. And these are these, you know...
Cloudy snail eaters?
Yeah. Obviously, well, I mean... People would go to Costa Rica, see their body weight in those, it seems like. So I feel like that would be an easier one. But honestly, I would love to see something like a Sicilian, for example. That'd be amazing. But, you know, I'm more interested in seeing a lot of those more iconic species that people see more easily than some of the rare species, just because, they're the ones that I grew up in seeing in books that got me into reptiles. So that's something I'll hopefully get to one day.
So I guess, you know, Nate or I, we could jot this down, but, you know, it kind of opens up the one of the questions we have here on the podcast to tell our guests of where would you want to go in the world to herp? Obviously, you expressed quite a few places already, but
Africa.
What's Africa?
Africa, for sure. Yeah.
What country?
Well, it's unfortunate because I would love to go to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but that's apparently really, really dangerous. And like some of those West African countries, just because I really want to see, I really want to see some of the Gaboon vipers out there. But you know, if I don't get to do that, there is Uganda. Uganda is another spot in another country in Africa that I'm really interested in visiting at some point. That is more realistic because they actually do tours. There's actually a guide service out there that I've spoken with a few times in the past. Oh, y'all had Sam on here. That's funny. I'll have to watch that episode. No, but at some point I'd love to go to Uganda, and there actually are herpetological guiding services out there that seem pretty legit. So hopefully one day I'll just
not
do that.
It's not just about the gorillas, even though they're awesome.
Yeah,
as well,
which would be cool too. But like, you know, these people that I'm talking about, and they have an Instagram page. I forget what the name of it is, but I think it's like Uganda Snake something. I forget. But like, they routinely post their tours finding East African Gaboon vipers and forest cobras and black mambas,
squams, you know.
They routinely are finding a lot of these species that like I grew up seeing in books that would just be incredible to see one day. So I think Uganda's a pretty safe bet that you could put for that, for sure.
Uganda's kind of interesting. It's kind of like the easternmost point. You find a lot of West African herpetofauna, like you mentioned, the Gaboon vipers, mountain gorillas. Yep. Also, I think Uganda is like the easternmost point you could find Ocelamus, the dwarf crocs.
Oh, yeah, I actually didn't know that. I love crocodilians, but I'm definitely more of a snake person. So you can get dwarf crocodiles out there then?
I think so, but I have to go over look at the records again. They might be kind of spotty. With those guys, they're kind of, you know, behaviorally, they're kind of interesting. They have that choice in that they'll just find like a little random ditch or pond in the middle of either can sometimes be very open habitat or dense forest. They'll just have this little pond all to themselves, basically.
Really? So do they behave kind of like the, there's caiman species in...
Like dwarf caiman.
Yeah. Like the ones in Central America, right?
I think the closest comparison to them would probably be the smooth front caiman. So that, which type of dwarf caiman is Paleocercus trigonatus. I think that's probably the best comparison.
Yeah, there's a small, I forget, like I said, it's probably the one that you're talking about. There's a smaller species of caiman that I've seen people finding in, I believe, Costa Rica, I'm pretty sure. And in the records that I've seen of that,
In Costa Rica, that'd be speckled caiman.
Okay, yeah, like they're doing the same thing, though, from like the videos that I've seen, at least, where they're literally just hanging out in little like puddles in the rainforest a lot of the times. They're not like in these giant... I'm sure you could see them in bigger rivers and wetland systems like that. But yeah, like people seem to find them in just flooded areas in a rainforest, which I always thought was crazy. I would expect them to be in more permanent bodies of water, but apparently not.
Osteolamus does that tend to be pretty terrestrial. Tend to do a lot of roaming around on land at night.
That's foraging. Very cool. Yeah, like Swaziland is another one in Africa that I'd love to visit at some point. And I believe there's berg adders out there, actually, if I'm remembering correctly. Did y'all ever watch Wild Recon growing up with Donald Schultz?
Was that that older English gentleman, or was he South African?
He was South African, yeah. He would skydive at the beginning of each episode. Y'all remember that?
You open up such a distant memory, dude.
Yeah, yeah. No. Like
I can't say that I have.
Yeah, he had this show called Wild Recon, and you know it was one of those like early lore Animal Planet shows that you know I would watch as a kid. And he did an episode on Swaziland where he went and found berg adders, which I thought was really really cool. I believe it was Swaziland that he went to find those. But yeah, I'd love to get down to South Africa at some point, because South Africa, from what I hear at least, is also a much more safe country too. So you know, you don't have to worry about that. Depends on where you are, right? But
well, I also depend on your skin tone, but
sure, yeah,
at the moment,
yeah,
it's kinda,
yeah, like I've heard Kruger National Forest, for example, National Park, for example, is not the safest place in the entire world. However, amazing it is, there's a lot of poachers down there that are not very friendly to many people at all, I guess I could say. So, South Africa, I think, would be really cool at some point. Anywhere that I'm not going to get taken by a poacher, I'd prefer that.
So that rules out Florida, I guess.
I suppose. I can't talk. Well, I can talk badly about some things in Florida. I won't hear, but regardless, I love Florida. I'm actually hoping to go to the Panhandle again at some point in the near-ish future. So I have a lot of fun experiences there for sure.
Good deal, man. Go for it, Nate.
Well, Bryant, you want to close us out or?
No, you got this, my man. Go for it.
All right. Thank you guys again for joining us for Reptile Ramblings. If you guys want to check out Serpentine Expeditions for your next herping tour, please use code CK25 at checkout. It'll get you $100 off. Hopefully that code's working. I still haven't gotten full contact with Ian yet about it, but hopefully by now it's up and running. And again, thanks to Eric.
My bad to cut you off. But yeah, I forgot. Shout out your YouTube, dude.
Yeah. I've got a YouTube channel. It's called Lost in the Woods. And I don't post as much as I used to. I get very into the video editing. So it takes me a really long time to finish ones. But I actually am going to be posting one about South Texas that I went to pretty recently. And if you want to check out my channel, it's called Lost in the Woods. Same thing with my Instagram. So.
You found Brian's kryptonite, South Texas.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. Well, I did get a Coniophanes while I got two Coniophanes while I was down there. So, you know, that was pretty cool.
Well, you saw, Nate, how I was quite generous tonight. I flirted around that specific region of Texas. So you're welcome.
I take it, y'all have not had the best luck there.
No. I mean, once I start talking about the RGV, I just start to go in the spiral, because that's where I first went in 21. When I went to Texas, really? I just spent most of my time in the RGV, and it was lovely. Obviously, it can be quite tough, but overall, love it. I love it.
Like I was mostly trying to get indigos, and I got two DORs, which was awful. But I'm hopefully going to go back again in November, because apparently, November,
don't
December.
Say that.
Yeah, like supposedly that's the best time to get them, is whenever it's like in the winter months. So, you know, I've got a buddy of mine that hopefully we're going to get down there together and redeem myself for my my past failures with indigo snakes. So, but
man, this is freaking epic. Just
stay
backstage with us, and then Ramblers, we'll see you on the next one.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
There you go.